everybody. I'm here with Dr. Walter Howard Smith Jr. Thank you for being here, Walter.
It's a pleasure to be here, Graham.
Oh, beautiful. Dr. Smith is a trustee of the Casey Family Programs Foundation, based in Seattle, Washington. This $2.6 billion operating foundation has a mission to provide, improve, and ultimately prevent the need for foster care, and it operates in all 50 states, the District of Columbia, U.S. Virgin Islands, and Puerto Rico. Dr. Smith's career focuses on the use of Bowen family systems theory to understand the functioning of families, organizations, and social groups. Dr. Smith is focused on understanding how family functioning from this perspective leads to family violence, particularly child abuse. He attended the postgraduate training program in Bowen theory at the Georgetown University Family Center. He is also a board member of the Pittsburgh Foundation, a community foundation that has a mission to improve the quality of life for the Pittsburgh region. Dr. Smith is a licensed psychologist with a private practice that specializes in treating children, families, and couples. His practice includes executive coaching, business and organization consultation, conferences, and lectures on child abuse and family violence from a systems perspective. Dr. Smith is the retired deputy director and clinical director at the Allegheny County Department of Human Services. He led child welfare services for a 1.2 million population county. Services under his leadership included child welfare services and prevention and community-based family support services. They had an annual budget of $260 million, and he managed over 700 staff. For 25 years, Dr. Smith was the clinical director and subsequently the executive director of Family Resources, a nonprofit organization that provided child abuse prevention and treatment services. Thank you again for being here, Walter.
It's a real pleasure. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. Is there anything you haven't done in your career? This is
I really have been fortunate, and one of the ways I describe it is I've always kept one foot in public service, and I think it kind of is rooted in a mother who was a social worker and talked often as I was growing up about the importance of community service, of working for children and families as she did throughout her career. So there's always been a part of me that, while kind of lured into private practice and that kind of work, I was always interested in making sure that I worked in public agencies, nonprofit organizations, work to kind of serve people that were more working class, poor, struggled because of the absence of sufficient resources, and always been a personal focus.
How did you? So one thing that I noticed is, well, just in your bio and haven't talked to you before, is kind of this effort to apply a different way of thinking to your work. What's that way of thinking? And
Yeah, I think one of the things that's been impressive to me is the dominance of the disease medical model, and not just how people think about problems and symptoms and functioning, but also the way people have thought about how services should be designed. And from my vantage point, what that has meant, Guillermo, is this whole notion that the fundamental problem are the symptoms that people have, and services are to be directed to alleviate those symptoms. And that model, has worked really well. I mean, I'm not criticizing it as much as just articulating that I've thought differently about, what does symptom formation look like, and what is the goal and the aim of the work that I was interested in doing? And for me, a different way of thinking has been that symptoms and problems, for lack of better words, naturally develop as a part of other more basic dynamics and emotional processes that occur in families. And so if you back up a little bit and look broader over a longer period, you know, their symptoms and problems are part of a sequence of changing events and circumstances in families. And for example, child abuse, which is a, an important public, important social issue, a common problem in families raising children. Often, if you back up a little bit and you look at how families are evolving and developing over time, you see that there are things that commonly happen that are a part of child abuse that have happened before, and child abuse is part of a larger process, a larger pattern of behavior. So, you know, to me, that's always been important to look at it from this larger context for a couple of reasons. One is, you know, I've always been interested when I became focused on child abuse and what does child abuse prevention look like? You know, and I think in all of health, we ought to think about, quote, prevention. I've always been struck that mental health doesn't have a really good prevention model, you know. And, you know, we talk a lot in healthcare about how we wait until people get a symptom and problem, and then there's all of these resources, you know, directed to, quote, alleviate it or treat it, that disease model. So, you know, if you're interested in prevention, you're always interested in, well, what is going on that's rather predictable before these bigger problems and symptoms emerge? And what does one try to do to address a process or pattern of this earlier? So I was always interested in that. And so kind of like help lean toward looking at this larger way of looking at things. And I can't say that there's only a few of us who think this way. I mean, I think there's lots of elements in our field that are interested in prevention, that are interested in, you know, public health models of service, that are interested in, you know, how do we invest dollars more upstream so we're focused on strengthening children and families, strengthening human functioning so we don't end up, you know, with so many symptoms. So there are lots of people that do that, but my interest is, has been how to think about that from a systems perspective, which is yet a bit different than your ordinary prevention models.
Well, I just stay with that for a second. What's different in thinking about prevention? How is systems thinking, family systems thinking, different than the regular?
It's a really interesting question, and I think all of us in this field, I think it's all still developing. But I think what Dr. Bowen was able to articulate in Bowen Family Systems Theory was that if we look at the functioning of a family not as separate interacting individuals, but as an emotional unit, and we think about family more than household. You know, or think about family more than just a nuclear family, but think about the emotional unit being this rather large, multi-generational, interacting group of people who are tied together through emotional attachment that is so strong that the relationships have a strong influence on the functioning of various members. So when you start looking at it from that perspective, I think what Dr. Bowen was able to articulate is that when anxiety elevates in one person or one part of a system, it rather spontaneously and quickly impacts the functioning of other members that are part of the same emotional unit. And tracking and following anxiety or conflict or unresolved conflict over time, one can begin to see, for example, something which is not common in the child abuse field, is that marital conflict may in fact be related to child abuse. So these things, instead of being separate problems that deserve their own mode of intervention or treatment are actually interrelated patterns of functioning of relationships within the same family unit. So parents who are having conflict tension may polarize, and as parents, the relationship polarizes, one or both parents may become very focused on one of their children, and that may in fact lead to an over-focus on that child in ways in which, tension, aggression gets focused in that way. So from this wider perspective, child abuse isn't separate from marital conflict. From this wider perspective, marital conflict isn't separate from unresolved conflict for each parent in their families of origin. These become interrelated dynamics, and another aspect of this, which is always kind of interesting, is that sometimes the very thing we do to manage one problem, we distance and we cut off, we decide to quit talking to our parents because if there is unresolved tension, actually, increases tension in a marriage. And then we distance and we cut off as a way of trying to manage that, but that increases the focus on maybe one of the children. So these aren't problems that people are caught in, all of us to some degree, because of bad intentions or inability to kind of, just do better. These sometimes are evolving patterns of behavior that actually have come from previous unresolved conflicts and tension. So it kind of takes the sting out of what it means to have a symptom or problem. It's not a judgment. It's not a statement about, the person, whether they're good or bad person. It is simply all of us at our best sometimes manage conflict, tension, anxieties in ways that actually downriver, escalate and lead to these problems of abuse.
How do you like some people might because I've talked with my students about this, and sometimes they hear that and they see they like one thought is that's shirking responsibility in some way, something like that. How do you talk to people about that?
Yeah, so thank you for raising that. It is one of the core ideas that almost one has to communicate when we're talking about family violence of some kind from a systems perspective, because there can be a lot of confusion around just because my behavior, which is aggressive, violent, and injures someone else, may in fact be part of a larger process. It doesn't diminish, from my point of view, that each of us are responsible for what we do. I can't say, well, it's not, you can't hold me accountable because my parents weren't did A, B, and C, or these events happened. You don't become less responsible because there's a way of explaining functioning from a larger point of view. Whether we intended to or meant to or not, each of us are responsible for our own functioning, our own behavior to manage it. In fact, that idea of responsibility is very important in terms of, the work around family violence. That it's real important to help people own and take responsibility to manage themselves, to regulate their own functioning. Because what you often see in violence, which is so interesting, is I have never met someone who's aggressive or violent who hasn't said, well, I only did that because, and then we'll give you like, the child did this, or my teenager did that, or my partner did XYZ. There is this oftentimes blaming posture that you see, which is part of the struggle. So this idea that each of us are responsible for what we do, whether we intend to do it, meant to do it, whether it's part of a larger process, is important. It's important to the services. A lot of my work was with parents who were involved in families where oftentimes one of the parent was aggressive with kids. It could be sexual, physical, verbal, emotional. And it's real common that you hear people say, well, if my kid just wouldn't have done X, I wouldn't have done Y, and you have to go, whoa, 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 stop, you don't get to, step back from being accountable. And in fact, being accountable is important because I think part of Dr. Bowen's idea in this work is, how to begin to manage yourself. Oftentimes you can't change if you're working on this, the larger system, but what you can do is change your part in it. And that requires us to take ownership of responsibility for our own functioning and not simply try to think because it's part of a larger process again that, it's not my fault. I didn't do it. I'm not responsible. I would say to some degree that kind of thinking is in most families, most couples I see will. When they're having a hard time working through marital conflict, well,
If only that
often
person would
say,
change.
yeah, I mean, yeah, I got upset, but it was because this other person did X, Y, Z. And it becomes really important that, it is possible to regulate one's own functioning, even if other people are doing things that could be, aggravating or triggering or upsetting.
Walter, I once heard you talk about, and in if I got it wrong, let me know. It's about the non-offending parent, and that makes a huge difference. How they handle things has a difference on outcomes for children, or something like to that effect.
Yeah, there's so much to that, and I did say that a version of that. It was always striking in Family Resources, my nonprofit organization where I was clinical director, then executive director. We served about 20,000 families a year where there was physical abuse or sexual abuse or there was some form of child abuse, and we were that organization. The people came into psychotherapy services of some kind. And it was interesting. We'd work with all members of the family. So we'd work with those families who were perpetrating abuse and non-abusing members of the family, children and teens who were designated as victims of the abuse. And it was always a workout to try to help the people who were in the non-abusing family member role to sort of see that maybe they had a part in the process. And to do that without hearing it was their fault that it happened. So we're back to that problem around responsibility and blame and fault. But it was really important. And it turned out that oftentimes when you had a common pattern would be one partner in a marriage or partnership relationship was a more aggressive, abusive partner. And you could see the reciprocal process that Dr. Bowen really describes well in the theory. To one degree, one person tended to be really aggressive. You would get the other partner accommodating, over-functioning, and to the degree to which that person was over-functioning, trying to manage everyone else. Oftentimes they would foster regression and the person who was more aggressive, they would end up being less responsible and then this person become more responsible. So you would get these polarization of roles, but the process was reciprocal in the relationship. And because we're so emotionally tied together. I think if one person can begin to shift their functioning in the way in which we're emotionally interconnected and tied with each other, it changes the process. So, you know, getting a over-functioning, non-abusing family member to begin to hold other people, the aggressive partner, more accountable for their own functioning, to hold them responsible for their own functioning, not seeing that if something, quote, bad was going on in the family, they needed to do more. But in fact, what they need to do was manage themselves, hold other people accountable. You would start to see what emerged was better limits and boundaries within families, better holding people accountable, better expecting that your partner manage themselves and function up. And that would decrease the risk of abuse. But it also would do some other important things. Children are a part of what happens in marriage and partnerships. So, children who might be injured by one parent may, in fact, have their functioning shaped a great deal by the other parent. It's important for them to see someone say, "Hey, no, it's not okay that you yell or lose control of your temper, that you use physical aggression when you're upset, that you are blaming of me as the child." And I see that it's not okay because my non-abusing parent is stepping in and setting limits and boundaries to that behavior. So there's actually some demonstration of it not being okay. So that non-abusing parent stepping up and managing themselves, you know, contributes a great deal to shifting the relationship dynamics and a family emotional system where everyone is highly emotionally interlocked, interlinked, tied together. It was always striking that the non-abusing parent, oftentimes, Guillermo, was some of the hardest people to keep in therapy. You know, they would say things like, "I'm here for my kid. Don't worry about me. I'm fine. Just here to make sure my kid gets treatment because my child was injured." Or, you know, "I'm here for the family. So what do I need to do to help them?" And I get it. I grew up in a family with a brother with schizophrenia. He was older. He was 4 years older. And for a lot of my functioning, I always saw my parents being the problem. You know, they just would have treated, get off my brother's back, quit putting so much pressure on him. He could function and do better. And then I would, you know, get angry with them and try to push them to change because I had a better idea about how they should be parents than they did. But I think it took a lot of my own work to begin to see how much I was a part of that process. That it wasn't me on the outside, you know, looking at them and what can I do to change them. But it really had to be the degree to which I was, quote, on the outside of that, that also pushed him and defined him in a reciprocal way to be caught on the inside of that. And then maybe I could do something to not be so emotionally distant and be more engaged and reduce the emotional cutoff with me and my brother and me and my parents. And maybe that was shift the functioning of this nuclear family. But that meant me working on me because as I tried to connect more, my anxiety would go up. And then I could distance because much more comfortable be on the outside and pointing fingers than sort of being on the inside. So I think, you know, all this ties together in terms of this idea about, you know, the families do function as a system of interconnected relationships or highly emotionally attached. And everyone is a part of that, even if they don't have symptoms, even if they're not the aggressive perpetrators of something like child abuse or domestic violence. They are still a part of that, and what they do to manage themselves can have an impact. And it's not about the kind of symptom. So whether in my practice I'm working with families where, you know, somebody is alcoholic, but they're not in treatment, but I'm seeing the other parent, you know, again, it's the same work. You know, it's not their fault that their partner's abusing alcohol, but they're not exactly out of it either. It's not like they have nothing to do with that when one looks at the relationship process. And then how do they begin to recognize the part they play in that and then work on themselves? And that's a different way of thinking about responsibility, but I would say it's a different way of thinking about what's possible for treatment and what's possible for services. Because I think our models typically, if you look at the larger scale, are, you know, somebody has a problem, that person needs to go to treatment. And then the treatment provider, the therapist, the program, the service, they need to do something to sort of up that person's symptoms and ha up their functioning, you know, which is not a bad idea. I mean, nobody wants somebody to walk around with symptoms when there might be, but you know, services that could help. But I think this whole framework says it's a lot more complicated than just that. And in fact, you know, in my own family, there are periods where my brother would do better, there would be more pressure on me. So one could think that the anxiety in the system didn't go away because my brother functioned better, it just shifted some. And sometimes it would shift to me, and sometimes I would do a really good job of shifting it back to my brother.
See, you should have become more dysfunctional, you know?
I did. My brother left the family for a year. And my parents worried about me in the way they worried about my brother.
Oh, interesting.
Ergo, my functioning went right down. And it was real clear to me when he kind of re-entered after an episode and the focus shifted back to him, that just how much, you know, what it meant to have an emotional focus on one of your kids because of unresolved issues in the previous generation that get managed by over-focusing on a child.
Wow.
It really became clear to me the impact of that, because it just illuminated, you know, like I thought I was managing my good function. You know, I've done pretty well, you know, I get grades, I was, you know, going through schools really easily, then suddenly my functioning dips. And son of a gun, you know, you think you're in control of your function until you get on the other side of an emotional focus and you realize, geez, how much you're up against.
Walter, how did you come into this way of thinking about symptoms and problems? It's like systems Bowen theory.
Yeah, it was a it was that I became a mental health therapist in 1973. I started to become a full-time therapist in 1977. And I early on, my third client as a mental health therapist was a family where the father had tried to commit suicide, the teenage daughter in the family had anorexia. The grandmother had just come out of a state mental hospital where she had been for a decade. And they were all sitting in front of me. And I was sitting there scratching my head, thinking, now what? You know, these things must be related to each other somehow. But I had no idea how. So then I got interested. And it was a time when the family therapy movement was expanding and national. So I went to some conferences and then started getting training. And I started my Bowen Family Systems training in Pittsburgh in 1978. But I think I saw Dr. Bowen's Chalk Talk tapes, which are black and white tapes about each one of the concepts. And he talked in one tape about nuclear family emotional process, in which he began to explain this idea of unresolved conflict in marriage and an emotional focus on a child and the impact on the functioning of the child. And it was the first time that I heard an explanation that really helped me understand the difference to my brother and I. You know, we had the same parents. We lived in the same household. We grew up in the same bedroom. He was a person that was most close to. And how I never could quite understand what the schizophrenogenic mother theory that was really common in back in those days, that and we both had the same mother, you know, we both had the same father. So how would you account for my ease in going through life and his struggle in going through life? And that explanation, it really stuck with me. And it just made sense that there is something bigger here than just, you know, what are the causes for mental health symptoms? And how does one step back a little bit and see the bigger picture? And then I went to the Georgetown Family Center from 80 to 83 and sort of launched a march towards better understanding theory. And to tell the whole story, and I'll just add a couple more elements to it. It was Dr. Bone had a couple of surgeries, I think 1980, 1981. And in between those surgeries, he did a tape about him dying and what he was leaving his legacy to the field. And I remember sitting in postgraduate program thinking, you know, if I didn't go to the Georgetown Family Center, how would I maintain this thinking for myself? And I decided I would reread Dr. Bowen's earliest work to see, well, how did he maintain a systems perspective when there weren't many other people around with that perspective? And I realized it'd be good for me to find a laboratory. And that was like 1981, 82. So when I went to the Child Abuse Agency, I knew then this would be a laboratory for me that I could go to this organization that specialized in seeing all the members of a family, and I could actually talk to them about what they saw, their observations, their experiences, and I could learn a lot about family functioning. But I had to keep in mind, it wasn't child abuse families I was learning about. It was all families that I was going to be looking for. What are those patterns and processes that may be evident in these families because it was a big symptom, but really are just part of families. And there might be some differences with child abuse and there are other families, but the important thing, the more basic patterns are going to be similar for all of us.
Is that what kept you going in it?
To this day, I think there's an advantage if you can find a symptom you can track and watch for a long period. And for me, it's been since 87. And it's been a long time. It's a lot of years, but 38 years later, I'm still at like asking some fundamental questions about how this, I think, works when it comes to family violence. But what an honor it's been. What an opportunity to find a symptom where the patterns and the processes become more evident because you're seeing things at the extreme, but you know that what you're seeing, even at the extreme, reflects what happens for all of us. And so it becomes a great opportunity to watch and learn.
Yeah, so because it's extreme, it's more evident, but that whatever's playing out is the same thing in all families to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we can do too often is think, you know, there's schizophrenic families and there's child abuse families and there's domestic violence families and there's, families, depressive. People get in, the field is full of categorization, where we tend to approach things back to this idea of disease model. We kind of categorize and we label and we then look. And it's not bad because it has been helpful, but there are limitations to it. And how does one work beyond those limitations?
What questions are you still asking, Walter? What's some you're sitting with now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny how So when I went to the Child Abuse Agency, I decided that each year I would ask a question, and then I would. One thing nice about the Bone Family Systems field, you can always write a paper and present it. So we had this conference in Pittsburgh that allowed me to have an audience, which was. So each year I would ask a question. I would watch, observe, make notes, write, track, and then I would present. The first year, the question was, what is child abuse? Because I learned pretty quickly in that definitions are really important. If you're going to try to do uniform observation, you have to define your terms and what you're trying to observe. Because it's easy to get messy when thinking. So it took a year to sort of for me to think through that. The second year was I had to quickly get into how professionals' emotional response to the families were a problem in trying to do therapy with the families. So how do you look at an organization and manage an organization? I was a clinical director, so how do you manage an organization so we can get out of people's way? So the third year, it was what's the role of marriage in child abuse? Just as a question. And the fourth year was what was the role of the non-abusing parent in families where there's child abuse? And I ended up doing like seven papers in 5 years because I was really kind of, it was interested. But to this day, some of those questions persist. And obviously at a different level, I've had the opportunity to see thousands of families, so there's a lot of variation. And you can describe things on the average, but the average doesn't always help clinically because when you're doing clinical work, you don't oftentimes just see the average, you also see the exception. So there's always like exceptions that are interesting. But I've spent a lot of time these days thinking about if society emotional process has a role, what is the role of the social emotional process in family violence? How does one account for the commonality of human aggression? It is just part of what we do. And how do I even begin to think about how common it is? When is human aggression a great advantage and adaptive? When is it a problem, and with how do those things all fit together? What shifts it from being something that can be useful to our advantage? We need aggression to protect ourselves from threats. How does one understand the way the very thing we do to protect ourselves can also become something that does us in?
That's always the case, right? The thing we do to survive, manage ourselves, bring the anxiety down, can exacerbate it, you know.
It does seem to be really common. I've seen a couple the other day who have done pretty good work at being able to sustain better emotional contact when there's conflict instead of distancing. But then when they sustain good emotional contact, other problems emerged. And they were sort of complaining about that to me, like, I thought things were going to get better whenever we were able to stay in contact. Sorry, it's not my fault. Sometimes the very thing you do to take a step forward, creates this whole other set of challenges, which are part of successful adaptation or finding some successful way. So this seems to be the nature of our human struggle, if not the struggle of other species.
Yeah, I've been thinking and talking about it a lot more like a dance than anything else. Everybody wants to know what to do, what they should do, how to do it. And it's really more what you're describing. You step here, something else happens, and then you got to step here, and it's unexpected. I don't know. It's,
I mean, I think it is, I think it gets back to another question about services. Because my training, a lot of it has been that I'm the psychologist, you know, I'm the one that sort of, you know, does something that helps people to change. You
I'm
know, I'm
still
the help,
working.
you know, I need to get in there and if things aren't changing, maybe I need to do something different, which, you know, because, you know, change ought to be driven by me. You know, I'm sort of the helper. And I think this larger perspective and stepping back and thinking more in terms of systems, I think one of the things that I was telling this the other day in another conversation, that in 1990, I had a chance to design a family therapy program in which the family got to pick their therapist. They got to pick how they were going to do their work. The therapist got to pick where they would do the work. They could do it at their home. They could do it in the office. They could do it. So what would happen if you just gave the families all the choices about what they did, who they worked with? So the program was sort of interesting because the family, each family would meet all the therapists in the program, and then they would choose one. And then they would drive the decisions. But I think the idea I was trying to get at then, and it developed differently later in child welfare, but the idea was, what would happen if clients sort of had to own responsibility for the work they did? And it wasn't so directed by the therapist coming up with our ideas about how people should work at things. But maybe our role in the process was, as Dr. Bone would describe, more as a coach, you know, helping people to better think about the work they want to do without getting into guiding and directing what that should be and how that should look. And it was pretty neat to kind of be involved in that because it really demonstrated to me how competent families are and figuring this out for themselves if we can just get out of the way. And
Why
I
did
think
you
we're in a way a lot. I think we're in a way a lot.
think helping gets in the way, or the way we help gets in the way?
Particularly when the helper needs to be helping. Because that's our need to be a helper. And, you know, I mean, even the therapist in the program said, well, what am I doing? And I would say, you're just track, just, you know, ask questions, just, you know, try to promote thinking, you know, help people sustain ownership of what it takes, quote, to get better. And there were some pretty serious issues in his family, but there was all kind of interesting things that popped up. So we had a therapist who had unresolved issues around a parent who was alcoholic. And every family that struggled with alcohol issues picked that therapist. We would joke a lot about, you know, well, how do you know to do that? I don't know how you knew to do that. And I'm not sure if it wasn't just, you know, a coincidence, but it was so striking, you know, the how much, you know, who the families would choose to work with also had to do with the family's own emotional process and how much the helper fit into that process. You know, so they said, oh, I really like that therapist. Well, we go, oh, you know, really like, it's sort of like dating, you know, oh, I really like that person as a partner. One has to think, so is that an individual choice or does that person fit into the emotional system you're a part of in some subtle and maybe overt ways that it just feels, they just feel like I just feel connected to them. And then you think selection has, Because any a supervised therapist over the years, people say, "Oh, I really like this family. We really work well together." And my thoughts always been like, wow. And supervision, sometimes what I would do when I was supervising therapists would I would create a theme for, okay, for the next month in supervision, bring in these kind of cases, because I was always interested in. And one of my favorite topics was people had to bring in cases of their favorite clients. Well, people say, "Who's my favorite?" I say, "Whoever it is that you think you're doing great work with, everything is going great. You find yourself motivated, interested in the client." And almost all the time, we would end up laughing because being that positively compatible had something to do with emotional process at a larger level for the therapist and for the client. And just because it was, quote, positive, people would associate that with better outcomes, which is what we helpers do. Like, oh, well, if I like this person and I think they're motivated and doing well, they're going to do better. Really? Like, so maybe could you try to pick the people that you don't like and then compare that? But anyway, in this program, it was an opportunity to sit back and really question, what is helping me? What is services? How can you serve without taking away the ownership and responsibility that people need to take to better manage their own functioning in the families that they are a part of, that I'm not a part of? And what does that look like? And I think Dr. Bowen described it just right, described it well in terms of what does it mean to be a coach?
It's so interesting, it's so interesting, Walter, that we are that tuned in that we could pick up on somebody in that way. They fit somehow the larger emotional process we're caught up in. Part of, I should say.
If I could live another life as a psychologist, I'd be really interested in mate selection. Because, like I once did a little paper, like what would a Bowen family system dating service look like, just as a
We
fun,
should create
just
an
a
app.
fun project. Because I was just, because just, how do you think differently? Because the way people commonly do it is around something like compatibility, whatever in the hell that is. I think from a larger point of view, what we see to be compatible at an individual level probably has all kinds of interesting implications. When you look at, I am picking someone that fits into my family and ways that are just perfect. But my experience is, oh, I just think they're the cutest thing in the whole world. And I'm just infatuated with who they are. I have no doubt that at some level of selection, these processes are operating. I've often said, in coaching leaders, you can't fire your way to a better organization, because it's really easy to get into like trying to fire what you perceive to be the worst functioning people, and you're going to hire better people. And I think these processes are at work, because at some level, the organization as an emotional system also has a large factor in choosing who gets hired and who doesn't get hired. If you're at some level of functioning and you want your organization to step up, how do you as a leader step up in your functioning and work on yourself and not think you can simply step it up by getting the right people in and those other people out? And but that's some of the basis of this.
Wow. It's like it's a really popular term now, the culture that you got to work on. But what you're saying is the leader's own emotional process is as important.
That is a way to work at this.
Yeah.
And it's one of the ways I was interested in working, when I was head of child welfare and I was leading a large, complicated social service system. I spent most of my time working on Walter. What it would take for me to function up as a part of the system rather than thinking about, all the other external factors that, I mean, child welfare is the hardest job I ever had, but it's so easy to get caught up in, the child dies or, there's battles with the courts and there's all kinds of tension within parts of the organization. It's easy to get caught in all that, thinking I need to fix and address all that. Yeah, those things are important. But fundamentally, how do I function at my best as I am the leader and a central part of how the social emotional system functions?
Walter, what's do you have like a story or example when you were working on something in yourself, or you had some kind of realization that played out in a change in what you did in the system, or a change you made in the system as well, in terms of
Yeah,
child welfare?
lots of those. So, one would be I child welfare is a pretty innovative field. It's there's a lot of social anxiety, but there's lots of opportunity for innovation in ways that it's not as rigidly institutionalized as some of the other branches, like mental health and some other branches of the field, healthcare. So one of the innovative models was family group decision making, family team conferencing, in which a child welfare system would bring families together and then they would decide on their plan for services. So I took one of those models and changed it, and the role of the caseworker was, I adjusted it so that the role of the caseworker was to organize family meetings in which the family would decide its own plan for how to keep children safe when there'd been an allegation of abuse or neglect. And it wasn't the agency would decide what the plan was for the family, but the family would bring together all the interested nuclear extended family members. And they would decide that became the plan. That's a plan that went to court. That's a plan that got child welfare services. What I added to that was all the people who worked with the family as professionals had to join monthly meetings of the family or meetings every 6 weeks. And the family could hold any of them accountable for their what they did or didn't do. And because I had a $260 million budget, but about $150 million of that was I paid providers to provide services. So I would say, well, you're not going to get paid unless you come to the meetings, So I could have leverage, to kind of force. So the therapists and, sometimes their lawyers and other service providers would come to meetings in which the families, when they're really good, the families would actually lead the meetings. So I had that my version of this, but there was a Supreme Court justice who ran the legal system for children in the state of Pennsylvania who had his own model, and he and I got into tension and conflict, and it was pretty anxiety provoking because Supreme Court justices have a fair amount of political leverage and power. I had a lot of respect for this person. And so I really had to work on Walter to manage that difference and tension. The Supreme Court justice could influence the president, judge in my region, and the head of family court. And so they are all lined up, with the Supreme Court justice. And there was all this pressure on not using my model, using the other model, and how to hold ground without getting into a polarization, without getting into, creating sides. Probably took all the work that I did for myself and my own family to manage. I had every right to, as child welfare director, to establish a model for my agency, but I also had to respond to the pressure of, somebody saying, no, we're not going to use that model, we're going to use this model. And it took about 3 years, but it worked out pretty well.
How did you bridge or create a bridge? It sounds like you did something like that.
Yeah, I just, so I have a saying that I give my clients, which is never let any issue become more important than the relationships. And so it's been a motto I followed for a long time, which is didn't worry about the differences. I just worried about, how do I sustain connection, good, regular, important contact, discussion about the differences, not to withdraw distance as I could in my family of origin, when up against my parents, how to articulate and hold on to what was important to me without it intentionally seeing it as up against somebody else, but in fact just where I stood, what were important principles to me that I stood up. So it's really a matter of managing and regulating my own emotional reactivity. And there are lots of examples of places where this thing bubbled up, and I just needed to sometimes just stay steady through it. So that made a big difference.
It's a lot to be said for managing self and consistency. I loved how you put it, the focus on the relationship, not the issue.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's wrong here. I
No.
wasn't wrong and they're not wrong. I mean, I sometimes have said, I have lots of sayings, but one of them is, if we all get on the same page, every model could work pretty well. Sometimes the problem isn't the model, the problem is, the fight over the models and, the fact that we get into those and then we get into who's right, who's wrong. I'm over here, you're over there. Sometimes, the polarization is more the problem. I often say, even in our country, if you're D or R, if we all got on the same page, we probably could make whatever works. There might be 10 right solutions to every problem. The problem isn't which solution's correct. The problem is which one can we all get behind? And how do you do that without losing yourself? How do you do that without, sort of being on top or giving in and giving up yourself? It's really the challenge. But the nice thing about working over these years in the public sector has been that this is the work. I mean, this is, I got lots of awards for my work. One was from the local psychological association for my lifetime work in the public sector. And I stood up in front of my psychology colleagues and said, where are you? You're like, how come you're not in child welfare or public mental health or working for a nonprofit? That's where the hard work is. I mean, being at an institution or a private practice, it's relatively simple. I mean, the real struggle is working with, families that are challenged in multiple ways. That's where we need the best, the most skill, the most experience. So thanks for acknowledging my work there, but how come I've been by myself?
Yeah. Do you think it's just the difficulty of it is that keeps people at arm's distance, or
No, I don't know. I do know that there is this. I mean, there are lots of pitfalls for professionals. I say to my the psychologists I've trained, The fortunate thing about you right now is you're stupid and you know you're stupid. The problem is, you think the goal is in 5 or 10 years to get really smart. And you're actually gonna be more stupid when you're smart than you are right now. Because now you're asking really good questions and you're really curious and you know you don't know. And sometimes our professions push us to act like we know. I'm just not that impressed that, I mean, people have done really great work. So it's not about the effort or intention or, but I think sometimes as a field of science, we would all do better if we kept the questions alive throughout our career and not sort of get so focused on acting like we know the answers.
So that, what's that phrase, that saying, the more I know, the more I realize I don't know, you know?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. And I think it's one thing to think it, and I think it's another thing to live it. And I think one of the great things about one foot in public service is that, try to run a child welfare agency and you'll see how stupid you are. I mean, you think you know something, and then, boy, you get up against a system that's trying to keep kids alive and not killed. And it doesn't happen, and you sit at a death review meeting reviewing, how kids died in this situation, this family, and boy, you just it'll keep you awake for a while.
How did you, like, even just hearing that, I can feel my own empathy, anxiety. How did you stay curious in the face of that? How'd you stay, like, thoughtful?
I mean, at times you don't. Times you sputter into, what's wrong with me? What should I have done? What didn't we do? It's kind of get defensive and protective. But I think all in all, if you can keep a broader perspective and not get too zeroed in on that there are specific things you have to do to fix things. Because what I've seen over the years is oftentimes doesn't fix things. It may address the anxiety you had about the last incident, but it doesn't necessarily address the next incident, which may happen for all kinds of very different reasons and in very different situations. So if you can keep your thinking broad and keep your focus on that, it's also good motivation for like prevention. You can't, I mean, what we do so often is you wait until the biggest symptom shows up. And the way our systems run, that's when we have the most resources. So there's more money for therapy when, somebody has the biggest symptoms. There's more money for public services when families have the greatest issues. But how do you kind of move that upstream? So it's motivation to think, what does it mean for prevention? And I think we're doing better as a society. I mean, over a century and a half of really kind of understanding more and more about child abuse. I think the rates are kind of ticking downward. Violence in general is kind of ticking downward. But boy, there's still lots of ways in which, what you see is if you get overly emotionally reactive to particular moments, then you're likely not to do good thinking about what to do next. So how do you regulate your functioning? How do you kind of, stay tuned in that there are some serious problems that need to be addressed, but tick down the emotionality that's in that with the idea that an emotional response may in fact not be the best response. My state, in response to an upper middle class person who was sexually involved with kids redid mandated reporting laws so that 300,000 professionals in the state of Pennsylvania every 2 years have to be trained on how to report child abuse, and reports increased by 80%. Are we safer? I don't think so. I think we've overburdened systems. I don't know that we're safer. As I said to the head of child welfare in the state at the time, like most kids who are abused aren't in child welfare systems. Child welfare just addresses a sliver of the cases. And if you think people reporting more actually results in more safety, I think the data supports that. So, but that can be a response to what happened in a moment that quells the anxiety, but doesn't really address the longer term processes. So it points always in the direction when you think about prevention of seeing the bigger picture and retaining that larger view.
I liked what you said about prevention being catching patterns, rather than just waiting for a symptom to pop up and responding to it. How do you catch the patterns that trickle down?
The patterns are really important. I think there are patterns, and there's always variation. So no matter what pattern you think you've nailed down, there's variation to it. And so it's how do you catch the patterns, and then how do you catch the variations to the patterns that you see? Because patterns don't encompass every incident. It's what I've always liked about clinical services. You can learn a lot about human functioning, but then the next person that you talk to might be the variant, might be the one that's on that's outside of what you've learned. And what do you do with that? That's when you need a theory, and that's when you need a way of thinking that is comprehensive, that is broad, that is based on principles. That allows you to, in a moment, think through how do I best manage and respond to this.
That's something I've been trying to get across to students, is that the way of thinking about humans is more important than the therapeutic technique most of the time.
And you need the technique,
And you need the technique.
which is. You know, which is, you know, it's a, that's the learning of this. I have a granddaughter's on her way to becoming a clinical psychologist, and she's always asking me, and well, I'm going to be done soon. I said, oh no, sorry, you're never going to be done. you're just getting your green card to open the door to be able to sort of like get into a field where the questions are interesting, they're fascinating, they're mind-boggling. There aren't clear answers. The moment you think you have the answer, boy, just keep doing clinical practice and you'll see the variations will humble you.
Ain't that the truth? It's when you were talking about being the clinical director for the child welfare, I was thinking how useful to have, or there's some usefulness in having a big challenge in front of you.
Yeah, it is. And I would say for me, I had a colleague I was talking to this morning about this. She's really quite brilliant. And we were talking about I went in to take on the hardest role of my career, heading child welfare when I was, 59, 60. And how useful it was to be at that stage of my career to do that and not 10 years before or 20 years before. And because the complexity is pretty enormous. I mean, it is good to have those challenges in front of you, and it's also been useful to be able to use, decades of experience to figure out what do you do with those challenges. And how you manage them.
You want the right challenge at the right time.
Right challenge at the right time. And it It's humbling how big those challenges can be, but it's important that that we take them on.
Walter, how many grandkids you got now?
Five.
Oh my God. What's been the neatest thing about being a grandpa?
Some of what I've said, and that is watching the next generation emerge into the world and trying to sort through for themselves, what's important, what they're going to do, not do, what they value, what direction they're going to go in, how to be a part of that, and again, being humbled by not trying to control it or being in there with them without trying to guide and direct what it looks like. So it's there's a lots of work that once you get started, that you never quit doing,
Managing yourself doesn't stop, I guess.
My relationship with my wife shapes, family, so, in my family, we've had Sunday family dinner every week for 30 years, and it's been a way to sort of, whatever ages, whatever levels of development my family's been, people come to my house every Sunday. So, my parents came before they passed, and my in-laws before they passed, and other relatives. It's been a good tradition to just, keep working at this. Sometimes successfully, sometimes I'm just humbled by how immature I can get.
Oh, I'm always humbled by how my own immaturity.
Striking.
Walter, what's just thinking about family emotional process, what's a pattern or what's been a pattern in your marriage that you think was useful to your kids? Like a way you and you're related to your wife?
I think the most important one is how to stay. It's the one I grew up with, at times when things are tense, how to stay connected. My tendency to drift is pretty big. My tendency to think I'm not drifting, but then to be drifting is pretty big. To sort of emotionally distance is pretty big, and to do it and looking pretty good is pretty big. So it has been quietly, working on me. And I, every year I have two or three things I'm working at for myself. I'm on my seventh 5-year plan. I write 5-year plans for myself. What are my goals over 5 years for my work? I don't tell anybody what they are. And it's my way of trying to have something for myself that I need to be thinking about and working on. And it's not unlike those that 5 years I've asked myself questions in the child abuse agency, then I didn't tell anybody what those questions were. Because so that's been the work. But I would say when I'm working on me and managing myself better, my marriage goes better. And I think that has far-reaching influences on the other important relationships in my family.
I'm a drifter too. I can drift with the best of them, but give off the appearance that I'm not drifting.
I'm with you. I know how to do it well, and I have a wife who can catch me at it pretty well too, so.
Mine too. Walter, what's so in your new kind of well, I don't think it's particularly new with the Casey Foundation, kind of national foundation. You're in the 50 states. What are you working on there?
Yeah, I think one of the things that Casey's really given me an opportunity to look at is social emotional process, and that is To widen the lens even broader, a lot of my work has been more local to the Pittsburgh region, and this is my hometown. I grew up in it. I know it well and have a really broad set of relationships. But Casey's really given me the chance. Operating foundations are a little bit different animals than grant giving foundations. We don't give out grants. We do the work, and trustees and operating foundations are more actively involved in helping to form strategy, helping to shape the direction of the work at really broad levels. So it's busy. It's about 900 hours a year of work, so it's almost like a half-time job, and it's but it gives me an opportunity to visit and to see and to talk to people. Whether it be, folks at the border who are just coming and immigrating, or, we work with 70 native tribes, about 100 tribes, about set contracts with about 70. So just another chance to look at, and observe and watch and hear and learn. We humans, we form social groups of all kinds, whether it be at societal level, but whether it be a culture or ethnic levels, and just a better opportunity to observe how all that works and how all of that may be related to some of the problems we struggle with greatly, but also watching what remarkable things we do to respond and to better manage our symptoms and problems.
Walter, you said social emotional process a couple of times. What can you just give a little description of, it's like a family process but broader, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think one way of thinking about it is human emotional attachment occurs at different levels of intensity. And, in general, the greatest level of intensity, I think, is family, where the levels of relationship attachment are so great. As I said earlier, it's almost hard to distinguish when you see one person in family anxious, what is it, where did that anxiety originate? Because you can't assume that, my wife has a funny look on her face, I'm already reacting to it, So we're so tied together, we're incredibly sensitive to each other. That happens in organizations to a lesser degree, in communities to a lesser degree, in societies to a lesser degree. But there is this interconnection, this attachment we have, in which you can see some of the same patterns that you observe in families happen in social groups, whether it be communities, organizations, or societies. Polarization, you can look at political polarization and see, there's a reciprocal relationship there, and it's easy to be defined by it. And so earlier we were talking about social services, how do you not just design a service, but how do you operate it? How do you function within it? So you're not just repeating patterns of functioning, that can make the service less effective, like, working in working with a native tribe, you see sometimes people step into the tribe with their idea about how the tribe should function. And you think that's not that different than a parent stepping into their child's life with their idea about how the child should think and what the child should do. And so you can see these similarities and patterns, and so you can see it at a societal level. In families, I have never seen, and I would say never, I've never seen families or problems where there aren't helpers. You know,
Interesting.
I often say, If you took any seven people, and this is my elevator story, and you threw them in an elevator, and the elevator got stuck, and then there are seven strangers, but the elevator rattles like it's going to fall 40 stories. What roles emerge? Well, there are some predictable roles that begin to emerge. But I've never seen families where there are people with problems or aren't helpers. I've never seen a community with a problem where there aren't people willing to lead, step up, and try to do something about it. I certainly was the helper, quote, with my brother. And so you can think about how, not just at a family level, but a society level, what does it mean as a foundation to want to help? And how do you help without getting in the way? And what does that look like? And it's not just giving money or getting in there and doing things for people. It's more complicated than that. And I think Casey does very, very well with trying to sort through big questions like that at this larger societal level. But what you see is emotional process at that level.
Wow. See, I thought you described that better than I've ever heard it.
Thank you.
When I was talking with Eric a few weeks ago, Eric Thompson, and he had a great line. Wasn't his was quoting somebody. The problem isn't solved on the level of the problem. It kind of reminds me of what you're talking about. It's not like attacking the polarization. If you try to attack the polarization, it's not gonna work. Gotta work on
Yeah,
the relationship.
it is I think it's part of our conversation today is, how you go about something, which is process, can be more important than what you're doing. And obviously, they're both important. You can't get around both, but I think we tend to miss when Casey is trying to help a community or a tribe. Our first question is, what do you want to do?
Wow.
What's your goal? And what are you going to do about how do we support your work? As opposed to, we have ideas about what you should do.
It's
And
definitely less imposing.
simple. Yeah, simple, but it's hard because there's a part of me that wants to fix things.
Yeah, what is that, Walter? Is that our anxiety? Because I have that too, that
My anxiety.
you want to jump in and make things better and
It's not my anxiety like it just belongs to Walter. It's the anxiety that I have that's a part of the system. I think it's in humans, and when that stuff gets called caring about somebody or helping. Or, I really love you. I want to do this for you. Boy, it really gets to be messy. And I think there's a lot of recognition of this. I mean, drug and alcohol tries to get to this idea through enabling. I think, there's in mental health, we talked about the wounded healer. There's been stuff written about that. So I think there is an idea that's not just in Bone Family Systems field, but this idea that some of what we do to quote help comes out of a desire to manage our own emotionality more than it is the recipient. I've called it selfish helping. It's like helping in order to regulate me as opposed to helping to, and what does it take to be an empathetic helper. I think it's an interesting question to stay on for a year, spend a year of your life trying to define and think about that.
Walt, a couple more questions. What, speaking of listening and reading, what are you reading right now?
I'm going to say something that's sort of
We're
interesting.
listening to.
Listening, yeah, I I spend a lot of time, I'm sort of quasi-retired, so I really kind of at Casey in my practice am thinking a lot about violence and relationship processes, and both in the organization and the work that we do with others at Casey, but also in the clients that I see. So I'm still on some of those really basic and fundamental questions we started with earlier today about trying to understand the patterns of relationship functioning that tend to be related to violence. But how does one go about prevention, with this? And what does that mean? It's complicated. It's prevention's not just a service, it's how do you try to do something about what you think is a predictable pattern that will lead to violence? And how do you sort of, what do you do to step in to not have that process, live out? And if you do step in, it's don't be as simple as, oh, I prevented the problem, so that's a good thing, because sometimes what you do to prevent something also creates something. And then, so I'm thinking a lot about those things.
Oh, sounds like you're thinking about the problem of our time, is what it is.
Yeah, what the heck, right?
Sounds like it. Walter, well, first of all, it's clear your effort to manage yourself has led to a lot of benefit in your life and others' lives. You've done a lot in your work. So thank you for that. And thank you for being here today. I
Well,
really.
thanks for this conversation. I did it because of who you are, and I know you, and we have the kind of relationship I knew it would be a good conversation. I think it has been, and I appreciate your questions and all your thoughtfulness.
Thank you, Walter. I appreciate you.
All the best.